This is an ABC podcast.
And g'day. Tara DeLandgraf with you for this midweek country hour, edging that little bit closer to Christmas each day. We're going to be taking a look at the story behind the native Christmas trees that are in full bloom along the south coast on today's program. And if you're looking to buy some iron ore for a loved one this festive season, I do hope you've got a few extra bucks in your bank account, because the commodity is hot property. The price of iron ore is sitting above $163 a ton today, which is quite extraordinary, I think, and we'll find out what's behind that shortly. And before the 1 o'clock news, we're going to be catching up with an Esperance legend who, after almost 56 years, is hanging up his wide-brimmed hat.
Cropping technologies have revolutionised the farming industry, probably worldwide, but especially in Esperance, where you know, when we first came here, goodness me, we'd have a dust storm every week because of so many livestock and just the dusty conditions. And there was very little cropping ever done on the sand plain, but now it's the best place in the world to put a crop in, thanks to cropping technologies.
Do hope you can join me when we look back at the last five decades with Rural Services Agent Neil Brindley a little later on the program. But first up, it's an issue that's divided the WA cattle industry 4 years ago, and producers have been given another chance to have their say on the future management of bovine Yoni's disease. Now, you might remember, following national deregulation of Yoni's disease in 2016, the WA cattle industry requested to continue regulation. That resulted in targeted surveillance and strict border controls on imported cattle. The surveillance program was completed earlier this year, and the Cattle Industry Funding Scheme Management Committee was charged with helping producers decide how to manage Yoni's going forward. Committee Chairman Steve Meerwald says, following consultation with producers around the state, a majority of submissions supported a stricter form of BJD management.
There were 34 submissions, so 31 from Western Australia and 3 from outside of Western Australia. And the majority of those submissions supported the continuance of border controls, as has been the case, but with enhanced conditions. And the reasoning behind that was the options paper that was prepared by DPIRD and provided as information back to industry suggested that the deregulated environment in the eastern states was actually enhancing or increasing the risk of Yoni's transmission, and that it was likely that maintaining the existing border entry conditions would in fact would pose an environment where there would be a deterioration in a certainty of prohibiting, or as much as possible, prohibiting the entry of Yoni. So the recommendation was, to maintain the existing status, we would need to have a more rigorous entry requirement for cattle from the eastern states, which was supported by the majority of the submissions that we received.
Given WA already has, the highest JBAS score around the country in terms of the requirements for importing cattle, what would that increased controls, I suppose, around the border look like?
Well, it means that the cattle that are coming in for breeding, essentially, or for longer term being in the West Australian environment, will need to have a more comprehensive testing regime before they come in. So that will be different depending on the circumstances. It's a bit more complicated than just saying it's going to be this. But it's a more onerous testing regime, and there will be a transition period over time where suppliers of breeding cattle, particularly into Western Australia, will have time to adapt their testing regime to meet those particular requirements. The biggest issue, I think, was outlined in discussions, is the effect that it has on the migration of large numbers of stock on a more permanent basis into Western Australia, particularly from the Northern Territory. And for producers who have properties that either straddle the border or have properties on either side of the border. So in the instance that there was a reasonably good season in WA and things were in the Kimberley, and the Northern Territory was dry and somebody had 2,000 or 3,000 heifers that they wanted to move into Western Australia for a permanent on a permanent basis, that would be challenging for them, because if they don't have, if they haven't run the testing regime and their cattle aren't qualified to come into WA, they can't do that.
So, Steve, now industry has met and the Cattle IFS Management Committee has been able to put this recommendation forward to the Department of Primary Industries. Where does the process go from there? Is it up to the department now to implement those new import conditions? How does that work?
So our position isn't to make the decision. Our position is to allow or facilitate an industry position. And I think we've done that to the best of our ability. We realise that that it's not going to suit everybody and that there will be some continuing issues, in particularly in the north. But we believe we've reflected the majority view of the cattle industry in Western Australia and gone to some considerable effort to make sure that that process was as consultative and cooperative as possible. The recommendation now has gone to the department. They will work towards further communication with industry, advising them of the time frame for those conditions being implemented and advising of the transitional arrangements. Now, that's not only an issue for Western Australia, it will be an issue for producers in Eastern Australia who supply cattle into WA. So we really want to make sure that it's clear, advised well in advance, so that businesses have the time to adapt over a reasonable period of time to meet these new requirements.
That's Cattle Industry Funding Scheme Management Committee Chairman Steve Meerwald there. Well, as you just heard, the discussion in Western Australia around BJD management has been quite complex, and not everyone agrees that regulation is the best approach. Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association Chair David Stoat says introducing stricter import conditions on cattle is a disappointing result for northern producers around the WA-NT border.
Yeah, look, the KBCA didn't support the continued regulation, so the decision from the committee is surprising and puzzling to us. The work from the department in a few years ago clearly showed that the costs of continued BJD regulation were greater than the benefits. So it's puzzling that the committee could come up with this decision. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
What's already involved when it comes to the management of BJD, and what do you think that's going to evolve into now if there's stricter conditions around that? My understanding, it's already quite an onerous process.
Yeah, so, I mean, how it's sort of affected now, if stud breeders want to bring bulls in for sale in Western Australia, they have to have done the BJD testing over a number of years to prove freedom from BJD. So the worrying thing is enhanced regulation, which if the existing regulations are greater than the cost of the existing regulations are greater than the benefits, if we go to even more onerous regulations, that's going to see the cost-benefit analysis go further in the red. So that's very concerning for industry, I believe. The fact that we don't know what they are and when they'll come into effect is also of great concern.
What sort of impact do you think that could have on the northern herd going forward?
Well, there's obviously great difficulties for businesses that have properties on both sides of the border, which there are a number of here in the Kimberley. So they should be able to move cattle between their properties with a great deal of ease. It also means if cattle want to come from the territory to be exported, it'll make it difficult for that to happen. So there's also those concerns, but then there's also the concerns put on stud breeders who wish to bring genetics into the state for sale. And it may, depending on how onerous the additional regulations get, it may make it impossible for that to happen.
I guess a really important event on the northern pastoral calendar is the Fitzroy Bull Sale. A lot of producers in the area get their pick of some of the finest stud breeders from Queensland. I suppose that's something that will have to be considered with events like that.
Yeah, it certainly will. So it may make it difficult for that event to go ahead. There's also producers go over to Queensland and source bulls directly. So it'll make it harder for that to happen. So, yeah, look, it doesn't make sense to have different regulations in the north and the south, but it also doesn't make sense to have regulation around BJD in general. I mean, this is a disease that can be managed at a farm level with biosecurity plans in place. So that's what happens in other states. So I'm not quite sure why that can't happen in WA.
That's Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association Chair David Stoats speaking there with Courtney Fowler. And the new cattle import conditions are expected to be implemented by the middle of next year. For further information about the management of bovine Yoni's disease, just search online for DPIRD's Talking Biosecurity website. And look, I'd love to hear what you think. Do you agree with the more rigorous management approach to BJD, or do you think it should be left to individual producers to decide? You can let me know. Send me a text 0448 922 604. So that's how you can get in touch with the program today and tomorrow on the text line 0448 922 604. Well, to resources now, because we've been talking a fair bit about iron ore lately, with prices hitting highs of $177 a tonne this week. But it's not just good news for the major high-grade iron ore producers. The lower-grade producers are also enjoying the price spike. The difference between lower-grade and higher-grade iron ore has been as much as 40% in the last, well, few months, but at the moment the margins dropped to its lowest level in years. Analyst Philip Kirklechner says it's a perfect storm for those lower grade iron ore miners.
Yes, because of the general price level being so high, low grade is becoming attractive because, you know, the end users, the steel mills, are of course frustrated with these high price levels, and so are from time to time looking for lower grade ores. And I mean, the whole reason why the price level is so high is because there is a demand that exceeds supply, and buyers are struggling to get cargoes. And so in that situation, customers are not that picky, right? So that is good for low grade ores.
Just to give people an idea, I mean, the discount between the lower grade and higher grade ores is usually significantly larger, isn't it?
Yes, no, it has been a few years ago. It has been as large as 40% to 50%, or even higher. So yes, so it's quite extraordinary how this whole thing has changed. And I think it's really also a bit of the sign of the times that the volatility of the price level is increasing all the time, but also the relative pricing between the different products. And also the penalties for impurities like silica and alumina, that is changing all the time and have become more volatile. I can only guess that low-grade producers, even, you know, in the mid-low 50s, might be able to achieve closer to $100, which is quite amazing for a low-grade product to get paid that much, because, you know, it was only 5 years ago that the 62 index was at, you know, $37. So 5 years ago, customers are only willing to pay, you know, $36, $37 for a 62 on a high grade product. And now, you know, prices above 100 for a low grade product are not impossible anymore.
I suppose for Australian producers of low grade iron ore, it would be a bit of a game changer in terms of their profitability at the moment.
Well, it has huge consequences because it makes low-grade ores, which were previously not feasible, now feasible. And so it even changed the reserves statements of all the other producers as well, because a lot of big producers like Rio, BHP, FMG, a lot of them have lower-grade deposits, which, because of the economic aspect of the resource reserve conversion, do not get converted into a reserve. But now, all of a sudden, because of the price level so high, a lot of resources have become economic and so could be developed. So there could be more investment into iron ore because of this. And also, juniors with lower grade deposits all of a sudden have a better prospect. expect. Yeah, so the question is, will these higher prices, you know, cause more new projects to be put into production?
And I suppose it's hard to look into your crystal ball, Philip, but looking ahead at 2021, I mean, just how high do you think this iron ore price is going to get before it starts to turn back the other way?
Yeah, I don't think you can say that this particular level of 177 will be maintained, but surely a generally higher level, given, you know, if the positive factors continue, supply disruption as well as demand strong, I think you can look at generally high levels, which means in the current context is around $150. So not today's price, but a price sort of range that is considerably higher than you would have guessed a year ago, where most people would have said, look, we expect the future price to be in a band between $70 to $90. And now people generally might say, look, maybe it's a higher band of, say, $100 to $130. But that's again, assuming that the positive factors continue.
So that's Philip Kirk-Lechner there. He is the Director of Iron Ore Research. He was speaking with Courtney Fowler. And as I said earlier, that price of iron ore sitting above $163 a tonne today, which is just crazy prices, really, if you ask me. It has just gone 21 minutes past 12. You're listening to The Country Hour, Tara de Langraft with you. And if you've ever taken a drive along the south coast at this time of year, you would have noticed the native Christmas trees in full bloom. To the Noongar people, they're called Mudja, and they're a sign that summer is here. The tree is so iconic that the local people, that when the Esperance Noongar Aboriginal Corporation changed its name and focus 4 weeks ago, it chose the species as its logo and title. To explain more, here's Mudja Aboriginal Corporation Manager Kylie Ryan.
Well, Mudja is a Noongar word, so the Mudja tree is what we probably know better as the native Christmas tree or the Neutzia floribunda.
For those who may not have seen them, if they're living in the north of the state, what do they look like?
Well, most of the time they just look like a fairly obscure tree. They sort of stay evergreen throughout the year, but coming up to Christmas time, sort of November, December, they put on an absolutely splendid display of these orange blossoms that the bees just adore, and they just look spectacular. And we've got them right throughout sort of the Esperance area, magnificent displays out near Frenchman's Peak and Cape Le Grand. So there's certainly something to enjoy, and they certainly, for us, let us know that Christmas is on its way.
Absolutely. Really announcing that season. I suppose for the local Noongar people, though, they've got more of a history than what we may know. Can you explain a little bit more about it?
Oh, certainly. So for the Aboriginal people and the Noongar people in particular, the Mudja tree was an indicator of what was known as the Birruk season or summer. So that was December and January. If the tree flowered early, it meant that Birruk would be early. And if it flowered late, then Birruk would be late. So the Noongar knowledge tells us that when you see the flowers at their most vibrant, it is when it is the hottest time of year. And Noongars made use of the Mudja tree in many ways. They used the bark to make shields. They collected the gum that came from the wounds of the tree, which was sweet, and they used to eat that raw. And then the tree's flowering was also a sign for Noongar people that the crayfish were coming out of their caves for eating. So it had practical applications, but it also had spiritual or sacred meanings as well for the Noongar people. It's a spiritual carrier of wurn or spiritual power, and it was regarded as highly spiritual because it was a place where the spirits of those that had passed rested before they went on to Karamut, which is the land of the ancestors across the Western Ocean. There's a lovely story about the Mudja tree, which is a story about Mudja Yok. She was the Christmas tree woman. It's a Dreamtime story from long ago. She was a very beautiful Noongar woman with lovely golden hair. She was much loved by the Noongar people because she was helpful and kind. She became very ill, and this saddened the people. So before she died, she promised that she would come back to visit, and her spirit now comes back to visit in the Mudja tree. So when the golden flowers are displayed, she is resting here too, which brings everyone joy.
So, Kylie, the Mujar tree has become the logo for the group formerly known as Esperance Noongar Aboriginal Corporation, now known as Mujar. I mean, obviously, naming renaming the corporation after the tree, it goes to say that that would be the logo. But why rename it after that particular tree?
Well, I think for our directors and our members, when they thought about some options for what the corporation would be renamed moving forward, they wanted to choose something that was spiritual and sacred and practical, and that aligns with where they're hoping to move the direction of the corporation, and that is as a corporation that will be very valued to the community, that will help to build relationships and understanding between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. They want to help people form connections within the community, and they want to celebrate and educate people about Noongar cultural practices and history.
Now, as you mentioned, there have been some significant changes, not just in the name, but also in the direction. Until recently, the corporation was also managing some farmland on behalf of native title holders. What's happening with that going forward?
Well, in the spirit of reconciliation, we handed back the parcels of land that we were previously managers for, and moving forward, we're looking very much around that community purpose projects and programs, and a couple of the projects and programs we've been developing. One is our Noongar Kadich, which is about understanding Noongar, and we are running a series of activities and workshops in all sorts of settings, including schools or for professional businesses and agencies, and also for community members as well. And then the other probably major program we have is Nulla Mia, which is our place. And from that premises, we already run and are looking to build on the projects that we run, and some we've been running for a couple of years now as the Pallet to Furniture project, which works is funded through the WA Police Crime Prevention funding. And that works with young people and older people that are at risk of being in trouble with the law or already have been. And they turn those wooden pallets into all sorts of furniture, chairs and tables, and they've made Christmas trees and all sorts of stuff. And our Bush Tucker Garden project has been kicking off as well, and look at growing and propagating and hopefully getting some people upskilled and formally certified with certificates in horticulture and stuff like that. And then alongside of that, we've got art and craft activities, getting local Noongar and Aboriginal people engaged in creating art and craft that we can sell through our shop and gallery. And we're also looking at development of a mural project as well to get a lovely mural up at the premises.
A busy year ahead, it seems, for the Mujar Aboriginal Corporation. That's manager Kylie Ryan there, and their name change and focus was confirmed a month ago. So looking at that Mujar tree, the native Christmas tree, if you're not able to make it to the south coast over the next couple of weeks while those trees are blossoming, you can tune into the ABC TV news tonight, because intrepid reporter Mark Bennett has been out in the wilderness of the Stirling Ranges taking some beautiful shots of how these trees have come back after those devastating bushfires in recent years. He's sent me through some lovely pictures. They certainly are in full bloom. I'd love to know what things look like at your place, what it's the native flora looking like at Christmas time right around the state. You can send us a text on 0448 922 604. Also on the text, we've been asking for your comments today. Earlier in the program, we were talking about that issue that really has divided the WA cattle industry for a few years, looking at the future management of bovine Yoni's disease. On the text line, Doug says, "I'm involved in the cattle stud industry. Why do we have to make it harder to get cattle into WA? The system's been working well, and that's been proven by all the tests that were done a couple of years ago. More money wasted by the industry for producers to wear." And also on those iron ore prices, Karen from the Pilbara says, "Hi, great to hear that iron ore is $170 a tonne, and that's US a tonne. I'm assuming as the people of WA, we should be happy with our 70 cents a tonne royalty." She says that's a bit of a joke. It does seem like there's quite a disparity there, doesn't it, Karen? Look, more calls from you and texts from you. Let us know what things are looking like at your place, or on the bovine Yoni's disease or iron ore, or whatever you'd like to let us know about. 0448 0800 922 604, but it is edging up to 12:30, so let's get some news headlines now with Garrett Munty.
Thanks, Tara, and good afternoon. Two of Claremont killer Bradley Robert Edwards' victims have read out statements at his sentencing hearing in the WA Supreme Court. Edwards has been convicted of two murders in the 1990s. He'd also pleaded guilty to a home invasion and a rape. The victim of the home invasion said since her ordeal in 1988, she'd feared someone would attack her, and Edwards was the villain of her nightmares. The rape victim told the court Edwards wasn't an evil genius, but someone unremarkable who'd slipped through the cracks. The US President Donald Trump has rejected a $1.2 trillion coronavirus relief package, which was agreed upon by Congress after long delays. In a White House video, the president asked Congress to get rid of the unnecessary items in the legislation, such as financial assistance to other countries. He also said the $600 most Americans would have received as a lump payment should be increased to $2,000. And a decision on whether the 2021 AFL Grand Final will be a day or night game is likely to be made in April. The AFL is reviewing the 2020 decider, which was the first to be played outside of the traditional day time slot. Chief Executive Gillon McLachlan says he is open to having another night grand final. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Garrett Munty there in the newsroom. We will get more from him in about 29 minutes time. Between then and now, we are going to be talking with Neil Brindley, who is retiring after almost 56 years in the rural services game. A bit of an icon down here in the Esperance region, with his big hat and the gabble, of course. If you're at an auction anywhere across the region, you would have probably bumped into him or heard his iconic voice. So we'll get to that story a little later in the program. But before we do, let's head to the Weather Bureau, where Steph Bond is waiting for us. Steph, let's look at the next few days in the Southwest Land Division, please.
Afternoon, Tara. We have heat is the main concern for the Southwest Land Division over the next few days. Certainly today we're looking at temperatures in the high 30s and low 40s for the north and west parts of the Southwest Land Division, and temperatures reaching the mid 30s through the eastern and southern parts, apart from that far south coast. Tomorrow we will see things warm up quite a bit for that southern part, where temperatures are increasing to the high 30s and along that south coast up until like the low 30s. With this, we also may see an isolated shower or storm through the southwest and south coastal district tonight into early tomorrow morning, but we won't see any precipitation with those thunderstorms, but they're pretty isolated in nature. On Christmas Day, so that's Friday, we will see the heat remain through the north and central parts and extend into the eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division as well. The south coast and adjacent inland areas will get a slight cool reprieve from that heat on Friday, but we may see some showers and storms isolated in nature extend through the Great Southern and also the inland parts of the southeast coastal Esperance area. By the time we get to Boxing Day, we'll see that cooler change move through the southern parts of the Southwest Land Division, so temperatures in the mid to high 20s through most of the southern parts. Along the west coast, we're looking at temperatures still in those low to mid 30s, and in the northern parts still remaining hot, with kind of high 30s to low 40s. So because of those hot temperatures remaining, we do have some heat wave conditions expected through the majority of the Southwest Land Division over the next 3 days, because warm nights as well are going to stick around with those hot days.
Rightio. If we head to the north and the east...
Yes, so in the north, we still have some remnant moisture around the northern parts, particularly the Kimberley and the north interior, and that's just keeping some temperatures a bit cooler for those parts for today. But through the remainder of the Pilbara, Gascoyne and south interior, temperatures are once again warm, temperatures in their high 30s to low 40s. Showers and storms through the Kimberley and north interior for today, and very similar story for tomorrow. Showers and storms confined to the Kimberley and the north interior, and temperatures remaining warm and hot through the remainder of the north and east. On Friday, so Christmas Day, temperatures remaining very hot through that Gascoyne Pilbara region and warming up down through the southeastern parts of the state as well. Showers and storms may extend down through the Pilbara as well as the Kimberley and the North Interior. And also may extend just into the far northern parts of the Gascoyne as well. Maybe a very isolated shower storm through Goldfields, but once again, quite isolated in nature. And by the time we get to Sunday, similar story with some hot temperatures through those northwestern parts and showers and storms extending across the majority of the north of the state.
Rightio. Any warnings current that we should know about?
We have a strong wind warning for coastal waters near the west coast with some good afternoon sea breezes. And that's mainly the Leeuwin, Albany and Esperance coast, so extending along that south coast as well. And we do have a fire weather warning out for severe conditions through the coastal central west, the Gascoyne coast and the inland central west north. And there are still a few flood watches out and a few final flood watches for the Kimberley district and the flood in the Fitzroy River as well.
Steph Bond from the Bureau, thanks for keeping us up to date.
You too. Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Steph. That's Steph Bond, duty forecaster there. And if we have a look at that rainfall, as Steph mentioned, a few little lingering flood warnings out. Nothing to note in the last 24 hours to 9 a.m. in anywhere except the Kimberley, and really only two readings above 20 millimetres there as well. Nicholson had 36 millimetres and Yampi Sound had 40.
ABC Local Radio WA, Total Fire Bans.
Now, a total fire ban has been declared for today, the 23rd of December, with the local government districts in the Midwest Gascoyne region of Chapman Valley, Greater Geraldton and Northampton, in the Perth Metropolitan region, Armidale, Chittering, Gingin, Gosnells, Kalamunda, Mundaring, Serpentine, Jarrodale and Swan, and in the southwest region it includes Murray and Waroona. So at these times you must not light, maintain or use a fire in the open air, carry out any activities that could start a fire, and that includes open fires for the purpose of cooking, camping or outdoor entertainment, so they're not allowed. Hot work such as metalwork, grinding, welding, gas cutting is also not allowed in the open air except for businesses or industry where regulatory conditions are met, and off-road activities using a four-wheel drive, a quad bike, motorcycle, bobcat or similar, except for agricultural purposes or by businesses and industries if regulatory conditions are met there as well. Now, if a harvest and vehicle movement ban has been imposed by a local government, off-road activity by businesses and industries is banned. For a full list of activities that can or cannot be carried out during a total fire ban, visit dfes.wa.gov.au/totalfirebans.
ABC Local Radio Harvest Ban Information.
Talking of harvest bans, due to the risk of fire, the following shires have imposed a ban on harvesting and the use of any equipment that could potentially start a fire. They're the shires of Bridgetown Greenbushes, the Shire of Capel, the Shire of Boyup Brook, the City of Greater Geraldton, the City of Swan, and the Shire of Mora has just had its harvest ban lifted at 12:30. So if you'd like more detailed information, including, as I say, the lifting of those harvest bans, please do contact your local shire. The next harvest ban information we broadcast at 2:05 this afternoon.
This is the Country Hour with Tara De Landgraaft on ABC Local Radio WA.
It's 1:22. Well, Western Australia's peak commercial fishing lobby has set itself up for a bit of a stoush with the state, declaring its opposition to any new marine parks. The McGowan government has plans for two new marine park complexes in the north around the Buccaneer Archipelago and along the south coast near Esperance. Daryl Hockey is the chief executive of the WA Fishing Industry Council, and he says the fishing industry isn't convinced of the merits of marine parks and argues previous examples have been handled badly.
Believe it or not, we really don't know what's being planned. When we ask questions, we just get told that, you know, that the things are on the go slow. DBCA popped up in Esperance earlier this year with a draft map, which arbitrarily plonked an indicative area, which was about 200 kilometres east to west and 80 kilometres north to south. And all of our eyes nearly popped out of the heads because it was completely untenable. So they've gone back to the drawing board, or so they say, but they've probably got all sorts of other options drawn up for the coast all the way through to East Eucla and west to Albany and Walpole. But we haven't been engaged and consulted. We really don't know what's going on, but we're concerned that it could be a significant impact on the south coast communities and in the estuaries and near shore areas where some fishermen have been working the waters carefully and sustainably for over 100 years. It could well have a significant effect on recreational fishing and recreational four-wheel drive people. So,
in that case, with respect to both the South Coast Marine Park proposal and the Buccaneer Archipelago proposal, what is WAFIC's position? Is it one of support or is it not?
Daniel, our position is very clear. We do not want any more marine parks in this state. We want common sense to prevail. We are not expendable and we want a fair go.
The government has obviously put this on the agenda. What's your anticipation of the way the government might respond to that sort of a position?
For a start, we'd like to think that before they even have a consideration of a marine park, that they need to identify what the purpose is, what the glowing need is to have one. Once they've had that, they need to have a little bit of a think about how other stakeholders' interests can be taken into account. Right from the start of the planning, they need to have a true engagement and consultation process where people are actually heard. They need to have a compensation scheme that works, not like the current situation, but for the future, they would need to have a compensation system that actually works, that people clearly understand. And importantly, in advance, they should also take into account the displacement effects. That is, if people are going to be moved off some exclusion areas, they're going to be putting more pressure on others. And that can lead to knock-on impacts, which can affect the viability of fishing operations. So we believe all of those things should be taken into account. And we think that it's a pretty reasonable ask to the government to make sure that that process is in place before they consider future marine parks in this state.
So is it an outright opposition to marine parks or an opposition so long as you feel the government's consultation is inadequate?
Well, we're always constructive and open in our industry, and we've always provided the right input. Unfortunately, our interests have always been slowly eroded. In this situation, if they come up to us with a reasonable proposal, of course we'll look at it, but it's only if our interests are adequately taken into account. That's the key thing.
It's a well-established principle, I suppose, now that marine parks, to be effective, according to those people who favour them, need no-take or sanctuary zones where no type of fishing activity can occur. Do you accept that or do you actually have qualms about that?
Well, we have qualms about it given what I just said. We are already operating sustainably and we're independently audited to make sure that we're doing this. Look, our concern is that they see that fishing farmers are expendable. They're somehow inferior to the department's ideology. We think that we can protect the breeding population through smart management, and that's the approach that we're doing at the moment. And let's face it, every fish that's locked up in a marine park is one more fish that will have to be imported from overseas to maintain the equivalent consumer demand in this state. And every fish that comes in from overseas, it comes in with questionable provenance, questionable environmental management, food quality, occupational health and safety, and pay conditions. So if that's the future, well, I don't think many people in WA would particularly like that. We've been trying for years to make sure that we've got an environmentally sustainable commercial fishing industry, and we've got one. And therefore, that should be celebrated rather than damaged.
The counter-argument to that is that sanctuary zones allow fish populations to flourish and there's a spillover effect where more fish from those sanctuary zones move into other areas. Do you agree with that or do you not?
Well, we can go to the Ngarri Capes National Park, which is over in the southwest, which by the way, has caused us some significant dramas as well because the compensation scheme there has delivered some woefully inadequate offers to the fishermen for their displacement. For most of the key species that we're talking about, the ones that are commercially important, they don't move much at all. So there is no advantage by locking them up in a marine park.
That's WOFIC Chief Executive Daryl Hockey speaking there with Daniel Mercer. And just last week, three Indigenous land use agreements were signed with the state government to begin the creation of new marine parks across the Buccaneer Archipelago off the Kimberley coast. Now, the plans were co-designed with the traditional owner groups, and the draft is out for public comment on the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions website until May the 21st next year. Going forward, Environment Minister Stephen Dawson said there would be extensive consultation with commercial and recreational fishing, pearling and aquaculture sectors to negotiate changes that strike a balance between traditional owner, fishing and other needs. Well, one of those proposed marine parks was along the south coast near Esperance, so we'll stay in this neck of the woods for just a moment, because if you've ever spent some time in the Esperance region, the name Neil Brindley may ring a bell. For the past 55 years, he's worked for rural agencies, first with Wesfarmers, then Landmark, and as it's now known, Nutrien Ag Solutions. He's a regular with the gavel at auctions across the state, but next week, Neil will officially hang up his wide-brimmed hat. So, as he heads into retirement, I asked him how it all began.
Well, I guess in terms of agriculture, my folks were dairy farmers at Augusta, so I've been in agriculture all my life. But it was about October in 1964 when I said to the old man, well, he said to me, actually, what are you doing next year? And I said, well, I'm staying home on the farm working for you. And he said, the farm's not big enough. And at the time, my father was dealing with a guy called Campbell Williamson, who was a Wesfarmers agent from Margaret River. Bear in mind, my old man wasn't a real big client. But he said, write to Wesfarmers and see if they've got any room for you. So I wrote to Wesfarmers and said, look, I know which end of cow eats grass. You should employ me. I got a letter back and they said, well, you better come and have a talk. So I had an interview and went to Perth and I got a job. And so I started work with Wesfarmers in Perth, in the mail room, on the 11th of January, 1965.
Wow, so that's a long time ago, Neil. Like 55 years, is that right?
Going on 56 years ago, yes.
Wow, so since then, in the mailroom, you've obviously progressed your career quite considerably. Where did you go to from there?
Well, I spent 6 months in the mailroom and then 2.5 years in Midland Sale Yards in the stock department, then a transfer to Meriden as a trainee rep. I was a trainee for 12 months and then I went on the road as a rep at the age of 19 in Meriden. Then I got transferred to Muckinbuddin in 1971, and then Muckinbuddin became the second agency that Wesfarmers appointed. So I got moved back to Meriden at the end of 71, and then became the senior rep there, and then a branch manager in Bruce Rock in 1976 at the age of 26. And then a transfer to Narrogin in 1979, then a transfer to Bruce Rock in 1984, and then a transfer to Perth as the livestock manager in 1980, at the end of 1986, beginning of 87. And then I became a regional manager and assistant WA sales manager. And then the wool market started crashing in 89. Mm. And the AWC was buying back all the clip. And there was a huge recession in the rural economy. And at that stage, Wesfarmers had become a public company, so the pressure was on to reduce costs and all that sort of thing. And the consultant that the company got in said, well, you've already got the business model, and you only need three or four branches, the rest will be agents. So put up a proposal with Terry Haddleton, and it took 6 weeks for the company to make it, to confirm it, everything, and we came to Esperance on Anzac Day 1991.
So why Esperance, Neil? Why was that where you wanted to go?
Well, probably because Terry Haddleton, who I went into business with, was the branch manager down here, so had some knowledge on the Esperance region. And I guess my job in the company too was days were numbered anyway, so the opportunity to move down here was exceptional.
And, of course, at a time, as you say, that the wool price was crashing and the livestock game wasn't all that enticing. What kept you involved?
Well, I guess it's just one way to put food on the table. Yeah, I mean, the sheep were getting shot and farmers were getting paid $6 a head to shoot them. It was a flock reduction scheme. And it was just, it was a way of life.
Since then, obviously, things have changed enormously. I mean, we're looking at sheep prices at the moment. A lot have gone out of the Esperance region in the last 12 months due to a lack of water, but prices couldn't be any further from what they were back then.
Well, cropping technologies have revolutionised the farming industry, probably worldwide, but especially in Esperance, where you know, when we first came here, goodness me, we'd have a dust storm every week because of so many livestock and just the dusty conditions. And there was very little cropping ever done on the sand plain. But now, it's the best place in the world to put a crop in, thanks to cropping technologies.
So what have you seen as the biggest changes in farming in the region? As you mentioned, it's so different to what it was even three decades ago when it comes to stubble retention and at least keeping some of that soil here rather than out at sea.
Well, it is cropping technologies. I mean, it has revolutionised the farming industry worldwide, but like in Esperance, where you've got almost a guaranteed rainfall, particularly on the coast, it's just a matter of adding water, and it has turned Esperance into a sensational place to be farming.
Now, anybody who's been anywhere near a sale yard in the Esperance region over the last three decades would well and truly know your voice, Neil, because you are the auctioneer who we do hear up on the boards. Why did you turn your hand to that?
Well, I guess that was the way the industry was. Everybody had a go in my early days, and there were sales in every town, and auctioneers were required, and everybody was put on the rail to have a go.
And now you're hanging up your hat after almost 56 years. Will we still hear you at the auctions?
Yeah, I'll still be doing the bull sales and the ram sales and clearing sales and any other sales that are needed, for sure, absolutely.
So why now? Why is now the time to retire?
Well, it's an opportunity time, really, with lower stock numbers and plenty of staff and agents, and it's just an opportunity thing for us to do.
What do you see as the future for livestock in the region? As we said, a lot has left in the last couple of years.
I think it's going to be fairly steady. I mean, it's going to be low numbers. Bear in mind, in the early days, Esperance did have 4 million sheep, and now we might have 500,000 or 600,000. But the numbers, the people that are left in livestock now are very steady, and it's going to stay that way, I would say. You really can't see them going back into livestock big numbers, but economics will determine that.
What do you see as the biggest challenges facing farmers, maybe not even in the region, but across the state? Because you have spent a lot of time, as you say, right across the state.
Well, I guess like financial management has become the big goer now with farmers. The economy means that a lot of finance is needed these days and used, and that financial management is the biggest challenge.
If you set your mind back over the last 5.5 decades, what stands out to you? What are some of the memories you're taking with you into retirement?
Well, I'm not sure. There's probably too many of them, quite a few. I mean, the industry has just changed so much, and it's technology that's done it all for us. And I guess the biggest challenge we face is that technology hasn't been able to shear sheep for us now, and that's going to be the biggest challenge the sheep industry has.
You are hanging up the hat, as you say, not the gabble, because you'll be continuing on with the auctions. I hear you're a bit of a dab hand at golf. Will that take up some time?
Oh, I guess it will. Yeah, it'll be golf on Tuesdays and Thursdays and definitely Saturdays, and who knows, maybe even Sundays. But no, it'll be a great time.
And no doubt spending some time with people who you've grown to know and be friends with in the industry over the years. You must have met some people, Neil.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the list is very long, but obviously we'll catch up with quite a few people. I guess people say you're retiring, but I'm really not, because I've never had a job. It's always only been it's been a way of life, and I'm just changing my way of life. The opportunity's there to do it.
That's Neil Brindley there from Nutrien Ag Solutions in Esperance, who retires next week after almost 56 years. So we do wish him all the very best. Well, as Neil mentioned, wool and sheep prices certainly aren't what they used to be. And 2020 has been a year for the record books, hasn't it? But a small sheep herd is still hampering the recovery of Australia's national flock. That's according to Australian Wool Producers Forecasting Committee, which is forecasting production of 274 million kilograms of greasy wool in the 2020-2021 wool season. Committee Chair Russell Pattinson says while Australian farmers are predicted to get more wool per sheep shorn this year, they'll be shearing 5.5% less than last season.
Yeah, look, it's purely about sheep numbers, and you know, a large amount of Australia has been coming off, you know, a couple of years of really bad drought. So there was a large turnoff of sheep. Western Australia and Queensland are still having pretty tough seasonal conditions. There's been a large number of sheep shipped out of WA into the eastern states as a result of that. So it's very much about the number of sheep that are available. There has also been a little bit of a delay in shearing as well, which and people have been moving away from sort of the 8 to 8 month shearing and sort of more into the back into the 12 month area.
Your forecast for the 2020-2021 season, how does that rate historically in terms of volume?
Yeah, look, we're looking at wool production in Australia over the last couple of years has been at particularly low levels. You've got to go back to the 1920s, I think 24, 25, when we had production levels at around this area. And again, that's been really driven particularly by the drought in recent times. What is encouraging, though, and certainly the improved seasonal conditions are so well, except, as I mentioned, they haven't got there yet for Western Australia or Queensland, but grower intention of building their ewe flock is higher than we've seen for the last 3 or 4 years.
I know you've touched on how the conditions are looking for wool in Queensland and WA, but could you just explain more about how things are looking in the other wool-producing states?
Yeah, well, certainly New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia and Tasmania have had really improved seasonal conditions, which is particularly driving the production levels. New South Wales, we expect to increase year on year by 1%. Victoria up about 7%, South Australia up about 5%, and Tasmania are in double figures increase. So, yeah, there certainly has been a positive response, as I mentioned, purely as a result of seasonal conditions and increased fleece weight in those states.
How has the wool test data changed over time?
Yeah, look, for this season, we're seeing, this is on AWTA test data, and this again reflects the seasonal conditions. Average fibre diameter has increased by 0.2 of a micron. There's been a 2.9 millimetre increase in staple length, which is quite significant, and also a 1.3 increase in staple strength as well, and a 0.8% increase in yield. And again, those figures are reflecting the seasonal conditions across a lot of, but not all of, wool-growing region.
That's Australian Wool Production Forecasting Committee Chair Russell Pattinson speaking there with Lucas Forbes. It is almost time to head to the newsroom, but before we do, it was just mentioned that it really has been a year of extremes in agriculture, and farm finance is certainly no exception. Interest rates are at historic lows, while livestock and rural property prices are at record highs. So what's going to happen in 2021? David Claughton spoke to Alastair Bennett from ANZ in New South Wales and started by asking about future interest rates for farmers looking to continue in the game next season.
Yes, interest rates are at a historic low. I started my ag career when interest rates were in the high teens, so the last I've ever seen them in my career. There is still an interest cost, and these funds have to be repaid in over time.
What will it be, do you think?
So they need to be
3 or 4 or 5%, 6? Where is it sitting?
That's a difficult question. Interest rates are determined by a whole lot of factors in a farm and farm businesses. And yes, we have seen some agri finance out there with a 2 in the front, plenty at 3s and 4s. But look, it's all very different depending on the makeup of that farm business.
Alastair Bennett says rural property prices are also at record high levels, and farmers need to think carefully about whether they can get a return on investment if they buy something, even when interest rates are so low.
There have been quite a few acquisitions where it is next door, so large family businesses still aggregating, whereas I was out on a property a while ago where they bought in another geography to spread their geographic risk.
Well, look, the risk if you were borrowing to put in a crop or restock your livestock or buy a property, you'd be exposed to interest rates going up too. What's your forecast for interest rates?
Are interest rates going to stay where they are for the next 5 years? I don't know.
Can you lock in a loan at 2 point something for 4 or 5 years?
Absolutely.
Online seller Auctions Plus flagged the possibility of the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator reaching $10 a kilo next year after pushing through $8 this year. Alastair Bennett says there are some factors supporting that idea.
Both the herd and the flock is below long-term capacity, so another 2 or 3 million head of cattle into the beef herd in Australia wouldn't be out of line. That will have continued pressure on availability into the market. We have strong consumption. We have strong export markets. So could it get to $10 a kilogram next year? Possibly. Who knows? Farmers that I've met in the last couple of months are also working really carefully on their gross margins, their ability to put on weight on these animals. and making sure that they're still turning a dollar. But yeah, be interesting to see over the next 18 months where those stock values land. May see some upward pressure in retail beef as well.
So enjoy your steak at Christmas, because it might just be too expensive next year.
That's the ABC's David Claughton there. And that's just about it for us on today's program. Thanks so much for getting in touch, those who have sent texts through. We've had a few come through about the native Christmas tree, which are in full bloom right across southern parts of WA. I've just had a text to say plenty of WA native Christmas trees in and around Perth. And the Nayamunja is how Mandurah got its name. So thank you so much for sending that text through. You can do the same thing again tomorrow. Hope you can join us then for the Country Hour. Right now though, it is time for the news. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.